From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Greek emigre film director Kostas Gavras says the unifying theme in his movies is intolerance. In movies like Z, Missing, Betrayed, and his latest, The Music Box, he explores the intolerance of fascists and military regimes. Kostas Gavras discusses his movies and his life on today's Fresh Air. We also meet rock musician and producer Dave Edmonds and find out how a kid from Wales got turned on to American rockabilly. Rock historian Ed Ward plays us some early recordings by the Yardbirds, the British band that launched the careers of guitarist Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and Jimmy Page. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new collection of sports essays by the late baseball commissioner Bart Giamatti. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Philippine government troops today reportedly have taken back a number of buildings once held by rebels holed up in the capital's financial district. But thousands of civilians, including 210 Americans, remain trapped by the fighting. Television and radio reported quoted government sources as saying they liberated seven high-rise buildings taken by rebels during an abortive coup against President Corazon Aquino. But there was no immediate confirmation of the reports, and they did not indicate whether there had been any fighting for the buildings. Czechoslovakia Communist Party boss Karol Urbanek today announced the rehabilitation of 500,000 former party members expelled after the 1968 invasion. The announcement came one day after the Warsaw Pact condemned the invasion that put an end to the Prague Spring. More from Sylvia Poggioli in Prague.
Communist Party Secretary Karol Urbanek broke into a TV program to announce that the party is extending its hand to the 500,000 former party members. They had been expelled for their involvement in the liberal experiment known as socialism with a human face. Observers here said it is not likely the followers of the Prague Spring will accept Urbanek's offer to join in building a socialist Czechoslovakia. The announcement came a few hours after the main opposition group Civic Forum met with Prime Minister Ladislav Adamec to present their list of candidates for a new cabinet, which the opposition demands should more closely reflect the recent changes in Czech society. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Prague.
Former East German Communist Party chief Erich Honecker and other members of his ousted leadership were placed under house arrest today, and the government disarmed the Communist Party's private army. Meanwhile, angry East Germans surrounded police headquarters in several cities to halt the further destruction of secret police documents. The head of Colombia's aeronautics division said today a bomb caused last week's airplane disaster that killed 107 people. Leslie Werpsa has more from Bogota.
The mystery surrounding last week's airplane disaster ended today when Colombian Civil Aeronautics Director Yacid Castaño officially confirmed that a bomb exploded aboard the aircraft. A preliminary report from U.S. and Colombian authorities revealed that a bomb of considerable size set off near the plane's emergency door caused a second explosion in a fuel tank. The plane then burst into flames in the air and broke in three just 5 minutes after takeoff. No one survived the attack. Mr. Castaño said there is no proof that Colombian drug traffickers were behind the attack. But just a week before the airplane bomb, police and military had intensified operations against kingpin Pablo Escobar and just missed catching him in the jungle in his pajamas. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 12 points. It closed the day at 2741.68. This is NPR News. Closing arguments took place in the manslaughter trial of a Miami police officer, William Lozano, who shot a black motorcyclist in January, touching off 3 days of rioting. Jeff White has more from Miami.
Prosecuting attorney Don Horn said the shooting was a deliberate act and that Officer Lozano could have retreated behind his police car to avoid the approaching motorcycle. Horn said Lozano should have heard the motorcycle coming and that he could probably have seen the driver and passenger were black.
He had time to pull the gun, aim the gun, wait on the motorcycle to get there, and fire as it passed on his left.
In his closing arguments, defense attorney Roy Black said Lozano had no idea what color the motorcyclists were and emphasized that the case has nothing to do with racial prejudice. Black asked jurors to put themselves in Officer Lozano's place. He said Lozano had a right to protect himself when he saw a speeding motorcycle coming directly toward him, and the jurors should not try to second-guess the police officer. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
A Canadian television network reportedly is close to signing a deal to cover the 1991 Pan American Games in Havana, allowing the Cubans to sidestep a U.S. embargo. CTV plans to recapture some of the cost by selling coverage to ABC. NASA scientists said today they've used ancient Chinese annals to date one of the most powerful volcanic eruptions in recorded history. The blast 3,600 years ago inspired the legend of the sunken civilization of Atlantis. The Santorini volcano destroyed much of the Aegean Sea island of Thera and sent up enough sun-blocking debris into the atmosphere to chill the Earth's climate and cause a summer frost, heavy rain, crop failure, and famine in China. Astronomer Kevin Pang of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory concluded Thera was destroyed in 1600 BC with a margin of error of about 30 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 12 points. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Costa Gavras, the Greek emigre film director who's best known for his political thrillers. His 1969 film, Z, won an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. Set in Greece, it starred Yves Montand as a liberal politician assassinated by right-wing military officers. State of Siege also starred Montand. He played a U.S. CIA officer kidnapped and murdered by a radical guerrilla group in Uruguay. Both Z and State of Siege were French productions. Costa Gavras has lived in France since the 1950s. Costa Gavras has also made several American films. Missing starred Jack Lemmon as a father who goes to Chile in search of his son, who has disappeared during a military coup. The father suspects the U.S. Embassy is participating in a cover-up. In last year's movie Betrayed, Deborah Winger played an FBI officer who falls in love with the white supremacist she's investigating. Costa Gavras has a new film called The Music Box. Jessica Lange stars as a lawyer whose father, a Hungarian immigrant, is accused of Nazi war crimes. She doesn't believe the charges and defends her father in court. Until the end of the film, we don't know if the father is guilty or not, so we don't know how to feel toward him. I asked Costa Gavras if he wanted to play with that uncertainty in the film.
Absolutely. It's essential to not know about what the end is, and I beg the viewers who have seen the movie to not tell their friends what the end is. It's like telling them the end of a tennis game, who is the winner. I think you lose some of the pleasure to discover, like she discovers your father, like Jessica Lange, the character in the movie, discovers her father. That was really done in purpose from the very, very beginning.
Now, are you worried about that at all? I think it's actually really hard to keep the ending of a movie quiet.
I know, but, you know, I remember when I was younger, the Hitchcock movies, nobody used to say the end.
Mm-hmm.
So the thrillers, generally, it's better to not know the end. And I hope the journalists won't say the end of the on the antennas or in the articles they will write about the movie.
I remember when State of Siege was made, there were a couple of interviews with you in which you mentioned that you wanted to cast Yves Montand in the role of the American CIA agent who's held captive because you were afraid that an American actor would be a little over the top in their performance and that they'd make the CIA agent too unlikable. Now that you've been working more with American actors in your recent movies, do you still feel that way?
No, probably I had by that the time a very, let's say, one-way position. But if few actors I saw for that, I won't name them, especially one of them, would like to push the story in that direction. And he said he's a bad guy, we have to have him bad all the way down. I don't believe bad guys are bad guys all the way down. I think bad guys are great with their families, with their kids. We are very much used in the movies to see bad guys being really awful bad and having even their dogs being bad. I think the life is all different. And with Montan, we have so much collaboration. And when I told him he's someone who's doing bad things, but he's a good guy for his family. He's a good guy for even for his country because he follows a kind of policy the government or some people in the government have established, and he's executing it, and he accepted without any fear or any tentative to change it.
Well, this whole idea that bad guys aren't bad all the way through, that they're often really nice with their families, that has so much to do with your last two movies. It's one of the subjects that's raised in The Music Box, but also in Betrayed.
Sort of. You know, I remember seeing a movie on Hitler in his mountain house with the children and with his dog, and the movie was made in color, which was very unusual at the time. And Hitler looked so great person, and he laughs with his friends around of him. He's very good with the children. So I insist strongly and heavily, bad guys are not bad all the way down to everybody.
Now, how does that influence your casting? Like, in some kinds of movies, the bad guys have to be physically unattractive. Do you know what I mean? So you could tell
absolutely,
the good guy from the bad
absolutely.
Guy?
Absolutely. When they cast, we used to look like for guys like Jack Palance or, you know.
Right, exactly.
Which is also very fake.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a whole period in the movies in which we overdo it with in that direction. I mean, the bad guys were, as I was saying before, really bad. They have a bad face, they have bad hands, everything was ugly, and like if the appearance could change, could be as ugly as the soul or the brain. I think those things are not going together. With that idea in the head, we should say all the handsome guys and girls are beautiful people.
Has it been difficult for you to start directing American movies? Because of any cultural differences, also because of the language. I don't know how quickly you felt acclimated to directing in English and working with the kind of English colloquialisms that end up in movies.
That's not really the problem. The problem is to know that country, to have the time to stay more and travel around and see the people and speak with the people. I think the language and the colloquialisms and also the playing the language by the actors and understanding if it's a good or bad, it's not really a problem. I think for the acting, for me, it's a kind of music. If the music sounds okay, it's good. If it doesn't sound, it's like in a partition with notes. The problem for me is to stay in the country. So I did so since now 10 years. I spent a lot of time. I went around. I traveled. I saw a lot of people. So I have the feeling I know a little bit better than before, because in the early 70s, they asked me several times to make movies here, and I just refused because I didn't know the country.
So what have you done to try to get more of a grasp of American culture?
Oh, to go deeper to the country. For example, when I did Betrayed, mm-hmm. I went around the country. I traveled in several states. I went to Nebraska, to Idaho, to Montana, and I asked to visit farms. I asked to speak with farmers, to see people from closer. And I have another way also of doing it. I asked to my assistants to find television, local televisions and the national televisions, shows, tapes, with interviews and on the people. And all those elements permit me to have a kind of image. I'm not saying this is the right image. This is the exactly, I have the perfect image. But this is a little bit my opinion on what I'm seeing and my point of view. And for every director, he has a point of view, and he expresses his own point of view. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm. Film director Costa Gavras is my guest. His new movie is called The Music Box, and it stars Jessica Lange. I think several of your movies have been, in a way, about how fascism is manifested in different cultures. Can I ask what your first exposure to fascism was? Was it during World War II?
I prefer to speak about intolerance in my movies.
Oh, okay, as opposed to a more political?
It's supposed to be more precise, probably, or more vague, because fascism, it refers to a special regime like the Hitler's regime or the extreme right wing. I think sometimes the extreme left also, it has also his intolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some movies on that too. So, yes, I was exposed in intolerance, and I sometimes we all are exposed in intolerance every day around of us.
But what was the first manifestation of political intolerance that you experienced?
Oh, it was when I was in Greece during the civil war after the First World War, and the intolerance was everywhere, in every corner, in the schools. For example, I couldn't go to the university because my father was considered as being a leftist because he had fought against the Germans. And I couldn't go to the university. I had to go to France. I mean, it was one of the small elements of intolerance. And by the time you couldn't live every day in tolerance, only everyday life.
Now your father was a Russian immigrant who moved...
My family is coming from Russia. My father is there in Greece for years now, for several years.
Mm-hmm.
And he fought with the left-wing people against Germans during the German occupation. And all those guys after the liberation were considered as being communists. So they have been jailed, they lost their jobs, and they have, for years, they have a lot of problems. The kids couldn't go to the schools, to the university, essentially, because their fathers have been considered as communists.
Was there any other direct effects that your father's status as a political outcast had on you when you were growing up?
Oh, I don't have really personal memories, but it was everywhere. There was no any free speech. There was no any free newspapers. There was no... the police were everywhere. You have to have in your house, for example, a list with the people who are sleeping in the house. And if a cousin or a friend was coming to spend the evening with you, you have to go to the police because we didn't have a telephone to call them. We have to go to the police and to tell them that my cousin is coming today to sleep at home. If you didn't do it, you go to the jail next day.
Was it because you weren't allowed to go to a university in Greece that you decided to go to France and to attend the Sorbonne?
No, I couldn't go because my father's passed. I couldn't go to the university in Greece, so I decided to go to France.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were a poor family, I have to work also just to be able to. But fortunately, the French universities are all free. There's a lot of help. There used to be, and still is, help for the students. There's dormitories in... not very expensive, their restaurants, so forth. So, and I was able to make studies without needing a lot of money.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is film director Costa Gavras. His political thrillers include Z, State of Siege, Missing, Hannah Kay, and Betrayed. His new film, The Music Box, stars Jessica Lange as a lawyer whose father, a Hungarian immigrant, is accused of Nazi war crimes. She defends him during his trial. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director Costa Gavras is my guest. His new film is called The Music Box. You studied filmmaking in France.
That's right.
And I think, you know, early on in your film career, you started to make political movies with a political narrative theme. Were you ever politically active yourself? Were you ever a student activist or identified with any movement?
Not really, but let me tell you first that I don't consider my movies, I think all the movies are political movies. So people are characterized my movies only being political. I think every movie has a political contain. Every movie carries the philosophy and the political feelings of the persons who are doing it, the director, the writer, or both of them, and so forth. So my to ask directly to your question, my past. No, I never was affiliated to a party or to a political movement. I took positions, as most of the students did at the time, for example, against the war of Algeria, which De Gaulle was doing at the beginning. And then when De Gaulle did some good things, I was for De Gaulle. So essentially always try not to just be member of an ideology of a party, but to try to judge the governments or the parties from what they were doing. I think today the person I if you ask me for whom I vote in France, I vote for Mitterrand. I think it's the best candidate we have, and it's the best president we have,
mm-hmm.
we could have.
You started studying filmmaking in France at, I guess, about the time of the French New Wave. Now, the style of the French New Wave was really influenced by American genre films, gangster movies, westerns. Were you interested in pursuing that sensibility at all when you were starting off as a young filmmaker?
Yeah, the new wave is probably larger than that. The new wave is a kind of revolution in French cinema, which was after the war without any major change. So young people decided to get rid of the old directors who were doing the movies in a very traditional way with big crews, with big cameras and so forth. At the same time, they have the possibility to use smaller cameras and very fast stock, which they could shoot outside without so much light. So the techniques helped that new movement to do new movies. And those movies were much less expensive than the other ones. And every young man was enough to have a good story and a couple of actors accepting to play in this story, and they were doing the movies. So it was really a fundamental change for the French and the European cinema. I get into the movies. I was by then assistant to director. And I get to the, I started doing my first movie just at the very end of the movement, when the movement somehow was, let's say, exhausted and have proved all they have, it had to prove. And probably some of the new wave directors started doing the movies in a traditional way by the time.
Mm-hmm. The first movie that you made that, I think the first movie that you made that actually got shown in America at many movie houses was Z.
No, my first movie was Sleeping Car Murder.
But was that shown in the States?
That's right.
Oh, okay.
Z was quite the third movie. My first movie was Sleeping Car Murders, and it was really very, very well received. It was also put in a list among the 10 best of the year.
I see, okay. A movie like Z was very unusual in that it was a political film, it was a foreign film, and it was also a box office hit. And this was during a period when a lot of people wouldn't even go to see foreign movies because they didn't want to read subtitles in America. Did you have any ideas of why your film ended up being as successful as it did? Because I think it really went against the grain in terms of what was popular at the time, what was selling at the time.
This is a very tough question. I really don't know. It was a big surprise to us because we spent with my producer and more than 1 year trying to find the money to make the movie, and everybody was refusing. Most of the American companies based in Paris refused to make the movie. And so we insisted, we did all of us, actors and myself, the movie without being paid. And we were so surprised to see the success of the movie. And I was surprised to see the movie being shown in small towns in the United States with subtitles and having a big success. So this is a mystery. This is a mystery why. Probably it's linked to the period, to the theme, I don't know. Really, I don't know. Jean Cocteau, you probably know who he was. It's French poet. He used to say, there is rules for the success of the movies, but we don't know them.
That seems very accurate. Were there ever any reprisals against your family in Greece after Z came out?
No, I think they weren't home. They sent some people in home, and they were very aggressive, and I had a very strong mother. So she threw them out very aggressively and physically, and she said, if you need them, go to have them. He's in Paris. Here, you don't have anything to do. And they were old people, so they didn't really touch them. They didn't insist.
Now, what was the government like in Greece when Z came out?
Oh, God, it was the militaries, very aggressive, and I learned much later that we have 3 or 4 people to be on a blacklist to be assassinated or something like this. I don't know if it's truth or not, but I was told that because of Z and some other people, because of these songs and other people's before the statements they were making against them.
And you were never concerned? Let me put it this way. You never thought twice about making the movie out of fear that you or someone in your family would be hurt?
No, I told my family what I was making. So the father said, "Okay, go and do it. That's your story. We are here. We see how we face it if they will be against us." And since the movie became a big success, they couldn't touch them, of course.
Did you ever want to return to Greece and live there, make movies there?
No, because I left very young. And probably I will return to making movies, but not stay there all my time. I like to go there to see friends, to see my family, and have some vacation. It's a great place for that. But I'm so much taken with France, and my family is French now.
Mm-hmm. Film director Costa Gavras is my guest, and his new movie is called The Music Box. Have you run into much censorship in different countries, censorship of your movies?
Oh, yes. I think half of the countries, and half of the countries in the world, my movies weren't shown. Of course, when the regime's changing, my movies are shown. And let's say, for example, in the Eastern countries, my movies weren't shown, even Z. So I hope now they will be shown.
Mm-hmm. Your mother was Greek Orthodox and very religious. I was wondering if you were religious when you were growing up and if you are now.
Yes, I was. But very young, I started thinking, and I had a lot of disappointments. And I have a really negative relationship and discussion with God, and when he was accepting to be done, so I stay away. I'm away. I don't believe anymore. I'm agnostic.
Ah, okay.
And I don't like the way God is used either by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. You think a lot of people are self-serving in their use of their religion?
God, saying fake things. It's insane.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what your next movie will be?
Really not. Really not.
There's been periods during your career when you've gone around 4 years without making a movie. Was that out of was that because you didn't want to, or because you couldn't find a script that you liked, or was it hard getting work then?
No, it's essentially because I didn't have the script I would like to. A director and myself, I have four ideas and directions in my head, and I would like to find stories to speak about those directions and ideas. And if I don't find them, I won't do a movie, which is in a completely different way. And if I don't feel concerned, humanly and let's say historically, as you say, politically also, of course. Ideologically, I would say, if not philosophically.
Do you get sent a lot of screenplays that people assume will be right up your alley that you, in fact, don't like?
I receive a lot of scripts. After Z, I received hundreds of scripts on political assassinations. And then after Betrayed, after Missing, I received a lot of scripts on missing people and that kind of stories. And then I think people think, as I'm doing one story, I am ready to do the same story in different aspects. I'm trying to do different every time, which is not so easy. And sometimes the reason for what I can stay 2 or 3 years without doing anything.
Right. Well, I wish you the best with the new movie, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been film director Costa Gavras. His new movie, The Music Box, stars Jessica Lange. It's scheduled to open in New York and Los Angeles at the end of December and in other parts of the country in January. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be actress Isabella Gianni. In her new film, she portrays sculptor Camille Claudel, who was also the mistress of Rodin. She spent the last years of her life in a mental hospital. Gianni's other films include Nosferatu, The Story of Adele H., The Tenant, and Ishtar. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dave Edmonds grew up in Wales, but what he lived for was American rock and roll. After teaching himself record engineering and production, Edmonds has gone on to make several solo albums and produce such performers as the Fabulous Thunderbirds, K.D. Lang, Dion, and the Everly Brothers. Coming up, we talk with Dave Edmonds. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the beginning of one of Britain's most influential groups, the Yardbirds. And book critic John Leonard reviews Take Time for Paradise. It's a collection of essays about baseball and other sports written by the late commissioner of baseball, Abe Bartlett Giamatti. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Several former members of the East German leadership have now been put under house arrest, including deposed leader Erich Honecker. The move comes after investigations into a widespread corruption scandal. Deidre Berger has more from Berlin.
The federal prosecutor's office this morning said everyone who belonged to the ruling Politburo until a leadership shakeup in mid-October has been put under house arrest. The order is restricted to those members still living in the exclusive Wandlitz compound. This includes the 77-year-old bedridden former leader, Erich Honecker. The assistant prosecuting attorney said investigations on corruption and abuse of power have been opened against eight former top-ranking communist officials, some of whom are already in prison. An arrest warrant has also been issued for the well-known lawyer, Wolfgang Vogel. Earlier today, the federal prosecuting attorney resigned after colleagues charged he slowed down the corruption investigation. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Berlin.
For the first time since 1945, there will be virtually free travel within Germany beginning January 1st. East Berlin agreed today to do away with visas for visiting West Germans starting the first of the year. At the same time, East Germany agreed to drop its rule that West Germans must convert the equivalent of $14 into East German marks for each day of their stay in the East. Officials in West Germany say the country's unemployment rate has risen to 7.6% because of the number of East Germans arriving in the country. But a government spokesman says the number of people out of work was the lowest for November since 1981. An American woman has appeared in court in El Salvador after being accused of hiding a stash of weapons for leftist guerrillas at her home. Alan Tomlinson reports from San Salvador.
28-year-old Jennifer Casolo, a church worker from Seattle, was brought before a military tribunal here in San Salvador, where she has worked for years with the poor. Police raided her home during recent heavy fighting in the city. Acting on a tip from a captured guerrilla, they said they had dug up a big stash of arms and explosives in the American's backyard. Casolo was brought to the court in the back of a truck with dozens of other prisoners, their thumbs tied behind their backs. She spoke defiantly to reporters.
We are innocent. We're confident that the truth will come to light. And even if it doesn't come to light, it doesn't matter because we're innocent and we know that inside.
Casolo made a written declaration of her version of events to a military judge. He now has 72 hours to decide whether there's sufficient evidence to send the Seattle woman for trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in El Salvador.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 12 points to close at 2,741.68 on volume of some 155,800,000 shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Most rock groups go through personnel changes at least once in their history. The Beatles did, so have the Rolling Stones. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward recalls the many musicians who spun through the British group, the Yardbirds. Some of them went on to further fame and fortune.
Good evening, and welcome. And now it is time for Birdmerizing, Yardmerizing, in fact, most blues-wearing Yardbirds. Here they are, one by one. The drums, Jim McCarty. The rhythm guitar, Chris Dreyer. The bass, Paul Samuel Smith. Lead guitar, Eric Slohan Clapton. The singer and harp, Keith Rowe. Five live Yardbirds.
was a Friday night, sometime in 1964. While the kids in America dreamed their confused dreams of the Beatles ruling London, the hip kids in London were all wishing they could be at the famous Marquee Club. There, the Yardbirds, featuring the finest guitar player of all time, Eric Slowhand Clapton, played every Friday. Of all the young London bands playing Chicago-style blues, the Yardbirds were the tops. Thanks to Clapton's blues mania, they were more serious about the music than the Rolling Stones. And also thanks to him, they were more technically accomplished than anybody else in town. Manager, Giorgio Gomelsky, had other ideas, though. Pop songs, that was what was making money, and as soon as they recorded one, he was proven right. For Your Love had two immediate effects. First, it put the band into the top 10 here and in England, and second, it disgusted blues purist Clapton so much that he quit the group. Gomelsky didn't care. He had another flash guitarist waiting in the wings, the heir to a British banana importing fortune named Jeff Beck. This lineup got the band through 1965 and 66 and gave the fans another guitar god to worship. But nobody could have predicted the amazing turn of events that was just around the corner. Bassist Paul Samwell Smith quit in early 66 to become a record producer, and Gomelsky hired a studio player, Jimmy Page, who'd recorded on some early Kinks records, to replace him. Page wanted adventure, and he got it in September when Beck got sick and had to cancel some gigs. Guitarist Chris Drea switched to bass, and when Beck came back, he and Page started trading licks, and guitar fans were in heaven. If that sounds familiar, it's because it's from the soundtrack of the film Blow Up, the only recording of the raw blues this lineup of the band was famous for playing. Gomelsky, you see, wanted pop music. So here's what this legendary outfit recorded for him. Fell apart in November 1966 as the band toured America. Rich Kid Beck claimed to be sick and flew back home. Now the band belonged to Page, but here's the weird part. Although the Yardbirds lasted another 18 months, they only recorded four singles, all of them stupid pop songs with little or no guitar in them. The band was great live, but you'd never know it from the singles. They were also getting tired of Page, and one by one they found other work. But on one last tour of the States, Page gave a hint of what his new band, which he was calling the New Yardbirds, would sound like. Ironically, the live album on which this appears was suppressed by various legal actions as soon as it appeared.
I'll be the computer, did it stay as it go? I'm being abused and I think I should go. Come on, baby, I'm starting to crack. You're out to get me, you're on the
At least with Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page would get to play as much guitar as he wanted.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. Here's some more Yardbirds. This is Fresh Air. Welsh-born rocker Dave Edmunds is about to release his first studio album under his own name in 5 years. During most of the 80s, Edmunds has been busy producing other people, including the Fabulous Thunderbirds, the Stray Cats, and K.D. Lang. He also produced comeback albums for the Everly Brothers and Dion. Edmunds' career in rock and roll began in England in the late 60s as the singer and guitarist for the group Love Sculpture. In the 70s, he became known for his solo recordings and his playing with bassist Nick Lowe and their group Rockpile. Edmunds' new record, called Closer to the Flame, will be released this winter by Capitol. Here's my vote for the single. It's called King of Love. Let's go! Stuck really close to the roots of rock and roll?
Not really, I don't think so. I think I've done all kinds of things. I've done a bit of bluegrass and country I've flirted with sometimes, and just out-and-out pop stuff. Although it's, for some reason, people keep saying that all the time, you just stick to the basics of rock, and I don't think I actually do, but it's just that I'm known for that, if anything. Have I blown your question?
No, 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 not at all. I'm interested in what you grew up listening to.
Rock and roll.
Yeah. Well, you grew up in Wales, right? I mean, what was the radio like there?
Oh, there was BBC, and there was nothing at all musical or not popular music of anything. What we used to get was Radio Luxembourg from, it was a European station. It used to go all over Europe, and they used to play all the American stuff. That's what everyone used to listen to then.
I remember in the States during the British invasion. Everybody would try to sing and sometimes even talk with a British accent because people were so taken with the sound of the British groups. When you were young and in Wales, did you try to sing with an American accent?
I think I still do. It sounds very natural for me to sing with an American accent. Not quite as natural as it seems for Mick Jagger, because he goes a bit over the top with it, doesn't he? But sometimes it seems right, you know, and I don't think about it. It just comes out that way.
Do you ever think that Brits are even more into early rock and roll than a lot of Americans are?
Yes.
Well, what way is that?
I think it had more effect on us. England was like, way back in the 50s, it was like when I was a kid growing up, it was like England was black and white in like a film. You know, it was all very depressing and there wasn't much fun to be witnessed socially. Whereas in America, you had all that stuff and it was reflected in the music. And when kids in England heard that stuff, it was a real breath of fresh air. It had more of an effect because it was we were sharing a culture in a way, and being affected by a different culture, which was seemed like a hell of a lot of fun.
In the mid 70s, you were part of like the roots rock movement in England, you know, pub rock and new wave. And I'm thinking of, you know, the work you did on your own and with Rockpile. What did you think of what rock had become by then?
I don't think I've ever sat down to think about what rock has become. Especially in the early 70s. I mean, We were into pub rock because we were always all down the pub, you know. That was basically what it was. You went down the pub all the time. And guys like Nick Lowe and all the people I knew, when they weren't out on the road travelling and working, there was pub gigs developed in London where the bands would just set up and play for perhaps less than they normally would go out for, or even more in some cases if they weren't doing too well. And basically it was going down the pub and not thinking about the state of rock and roll. Far from it.
Let me play something that you recorded in the late 70s, mid-70s. This is Trouble Boys, and this is from one of your albums with basically the Rock Pile band behind you. Would you say something about this record?
Yeah, it was released as a single in England, and it was Billy Bramner's song, and it is Rock Pile backing me up.
The Trouble Boys came in, I guess they'd been out fighting and raving. It wasn't long before they moved in and picked up the girls we brought to the dance at the night spot. It was a tan, so I had to move fast to get my baby back from the Trouble Boys. 25 guys from the east side of the city, kings of hell racing in the neighborhood. Well, one of them walked up and started dancing with my girl who was crying, cause I didn't stop him. All I could say to my baby was, honey, this man is bigger than the both of us. He's a Trouble Boy, and his Trouble Boys all around me. No one likes getting psychic in the face. I don't know anyone to stand face to face with the Trouble Boy.
You started producing records in the 1970s, and I think you basically apprenticed while you had access to a studio in Wales.
Yeah.
How did you get access to the studio? Was it friends of yours who ran it?
Yeah, what it was just about 40 miles from my hometown of Cardiff. There's a little marketing town called Monmouth, and there's two guys who had a band. Their names were Kingsley Ward, Charles and Kingsley Ward, and they set up a little studio in a potato loft. So I just sort of teamed up with them and, in fact, went to live in the area and started using the studio and learning how to make records. I had this thing about I wanted to play all the instruments myself. I don't know why. Just to have control over it all, I suppose. And that was the perfect way to do it without any pressure of, like, booking studio time and all that. I just sort of... It was like sort of coming in the back door of the recording industry. Which I found a very comfortable way of doing it, and I learned to produce my own records.
I think you learned to produce in different styles. For instance, you did your own versions of some of Phil Spector's classic records. You did a version, for instance, of Baby, I Love You, and you did all the parts. You did all the instruments, all the voices.
That was just as a hobby, you know. I never used to make records with a view to releasing them. It was just in the same way as... kids around now, they'll buy a little four-track cassette recorder, and in their bedroom they got a little mixer and they just have fun in it. And that's what I was doing, but in a real studio, although not a very advanced studio. But it was everything I did was just for the fun of it, just for the hell of it. And somewhere along the line, then later, it got released.
Although you're no longer remaking Spector records, I think now you've got the production techniques at your fingertips. And for instance, on the new record by Dion that you produced, there's one track, Always in the Rain, that sounds like you're really using some
Spector-inspired
techniques there.
That's right. Well, I just called up all my old tricks, really. I just dialed them up and I thought, right, what did I used to do? And it was very easy. That came together very quickly and it was a lot of fun.
As long as
Have you ever been produced by someone who you felt had you all wrong in the final mix or in the final production style?
No, I've never been produced by anyone, really. Except with Jeff Lynne, but that was different. I mean, he wrote the song and he had it all in his head, so I was just doing the singing and playing the guitar. So, no, I've never been produced by anyone. It'd be awful. I'm quite opinionated in the studio, and I think unless it was the right person I'm working with, I'd clash with them.
Do you think it's a blessing to be able to produce yourself? Have you met a lot of performers who feel like their sound isn't the sound they wanted because they were with a producer who got it wrong?
Yeah, I don't know the whole thing about producers. What do they do? I don't know what a producer does. It can be anything from making the tea to completely to doing a Jeff Lynne and writing the song and writing the record, you know, the whole thing. It can be anything in between, and it is very difficult. It's a role. It's not a well-defined role.
Well, where on that scale do you fit?
I like to get with a band and feel that there's something that I can obviously contribute towards making a good record, where they might be good at certain things, but in the studio they don't quite know how to get it down onto tape and things like that. I can't just go in cold and hope that I'm going to come up with something. I have to feel, yeah, there's definitely something I can contribute to this project, mm-hmm. and I would hate for anyone else to get the job. You know, that sort of thing.
Let's go out with something from your new record. How about Every Time I See Her?
That sounds good to me.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. Words spill out on an empty page.
Guitarist, singer, and producer Dave Edmonds. His new album, Closer to the Flame, will be released soon by Capitol Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. In East Germany, there are increasing calls for the concept of reunification with West Germany, mostly, apparently, because many of the people are just fed up with revelations about corruption in the official Communist Party leadership within East Germany. Also, Czechoslovakia's prime minister has encouraging words for the opposition in that country. A report about the drug fight in the state of Maine, and we'll talk with singer-songwriter Bill Morrissey about his song on his brand new album. The song is called Handsome Molly, an old folk song redone by Bill Morrissey with harmony by Suzanne Vega.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The late A. Bartlett Giamatti was president of baseball's National League for the 1987 and 88 seasons and served as baseball commissioner from April to September of this year. A posthumous collection of his writing about our passion for sports has just been published. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Take Time for Paradise.
Bart Giamatti had been commissioner of Major League Baseball for just 6 months when he died so suddenly. He was mourned, and not only on the sports pages, with that passion we reserve for heroes snatched from us before their time, like JFK and Pope John XXIII, mourned with that excess of sentiment we summon up for everything that might have been. His gift was to make us feel that our love for the game was intellectually respectable. He'd been, after all, a Renaissance scholar, the author of books on Spencer's Fairy Queen and the modern university, a president of Yale. But he was also a Red Sox fan. That such a man, so steeped in the liberal arts of Western culture, took baseball seriously enough to make it his career, satisfied and gratified and dignified our simple enthusiasms. Sports writers especially were made to feel that they were poets. Take Time for Paradise is a series of lectures Giamatti delivered at the University of Michigan. It's very dignified. Witty and learned, quoting Aristotle, Shakespeare, Dante, Milton, Horace, Pindar, Blake, Thoreau and Dickens, Old Persian, Ancient Hebrew, and Jane Austen, it looks at sport as leisure opposed to work, sport as sacred ceremony, like religion, sport as artifact, like the city, sport as ritual, theater, community, radiance, art, and freedom. An occasion, he says, when pure energy and pure order create an instant of complete coherence. Odysseus, we are reminded, cheated in the funeral games near the end of the Iliad. Jogging, he says, is antisocial, the American androgene chasing good health. It is not civic or communal. No city comes of it. Baseball, as you'd expect, is Giamatti's favorite occasion of coherence. He calls it the most strenuously nostalgic of all our sports. Narrative and romance, America's plot, an epic of exile and return, a vast communal poem about separation, loss, and the hope for reunion. Oddly enough, it's on baseball that he's least persuasive. I don't see why baseball is any more epic than the Super Bowl narrative or the loneliness of the long-distance runner. When he goes on about the geometry of the game, squares, circles, parabolas, and pentagrams, he sounds like some Rosicrucian hyperventilating on the numerology of pyramids. I'm not even altogether happy with his romance with baseball's language. For me, the real poetry of baseball's language is the slow curve, the intentional walk, extra innings, rain delay, stealing home. And when he tells us that baseball was the first American institution to desegregate itself in 1947, even before the U.S. Army, he seems to have forgotten about the legal and medical professions, the universities, and the halls of Congress. But then I'm sufficiently churlish to remember Giamatti's tenure as president of Yale. He was very good at raising money, and not so hot at grasping the grievances of the university's poorly paid clerical workers when they went on strike. Nor did he see any reason why Yale should divest from South Africa. How would he have handled the collective bargaining agreement between owners and players? Baseball, a boy's game against the clock, is played, thank God, by athletes instead of intellectuals. It's less complicated than the Renaissance.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Take Time for Paradise by A. Bartlett Giamatti. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Isabelle Adjani, one of France's leading actresses. She starred in the story of Adèle H., Nosferatu, and the new film Camille Claudel. Also, TV critic Tom Shales tells us why the honeymooners used to scare him. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.